place. Resuming, I asked you about Covenant that Mr. Giddens has produced.
Can I respond to that question, Mr. Chair? Okay. So, what is attached is a clause from an agreement for sale and purchase. I don't understand it to be a covenant. Mr. Giddens refers to it in his paragraph 15 in terms of future resource consents and notices of requirement. If we look at clause 28, that's correct. So there's essentially a requirement in there that the council doesn't object to any future, consents. It's called planning proposals, but it's talking about lodging submissions on those, and that shall be deemed to have given written approval to any such planning proposal. That doesn't apply to this district plan review, if that was the suggestion of the question.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, that's good.
So the answer to the question is, it is kosher. It does say what it appears to say. Does it bind Scope Resources as the council's lessee? My interpretation of the archaic legal language at the end is that it does, but no doubt Mr. Nolan will have a view about that.
Yes, but again, not in the context of the plan review.
I understand that it's open slather in this forum. The reason why I was asking Mr. Place was in the context of his 518, which is a non-notification clause, effectively on the basis that if the council and its lessee are committed to consent, who's left standing who would conceivably be affected by anything that Cadrona Cattle Club wanted to do on this land?
This is in regard to the building coverage.
That's right. Like, that's a specific example.
But effectively, if the immediate neighbour is committed to support, who are you going to notify?
I'm thinking about it from a site by site perspective, but you're thinking more on a zone versus this landfill perspective.
Yes, correct. Well, I'm thinking about Cadrona Cattle Company site. Or is the point of this this is a zone wide clause? Is that why you're puzzled by my question?
Yeah.
It's zone wide, not limited. Well, that's a good answer.
That's correct.
I was intrigued by your suggestion that the 5.25, that the strategic clauses are giving more post-Environment Court are giving more protection to O&Ls. I suppose I read shall not impinge on O&Ls as being don't go there. Whereas protecting the value suggests you might be able to go there.
I think protect is more useful, protect the values, than do not impinge on, because it sets out, and following on from comments made by Mr. Jones in regard to the values, I think we can say that given that it's not protecting them, then it's relevant that it is stronger, in my opinion.
I suppose my point is that if you don't go there, then you're necessarily protecting the values and every other aspect of the O&L.
Sure, I guess do not impinge on could possibly mean to what extent do you impinge on rather than to not go there at all?
So that's an interpretation issue.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying. And lastly, 5.35, you're saying natural hazard at risk should be understood prior to the application of urban and own enabled zoning regime that's required through Chapter 28. Which provision in Chapter 28?
So, well, the purpose statement talks about the relevance of the chapter in the first instance to future plan change processes. So that sets out, I guess, at a very high level, that all of the objectives and policies are relevant. But in terms of so there's, I guess, a suite of directions that haven't been taken into account when, in my view, we're putting in quite significant urban zone in this location. So we haven't determined risk tolerance, and we haven't determined the significance of the risk in the first instance. And so the objective is I'm talking to the Chapter 28 as modified by the court for Topic 12, which is appended as Appendix 2 to my second rebuttal statement. Development on land subject to natural hazards only occurs where the risks to the community and built environment are appropriately managed. So that's 28.31b.
Can I interpolate? Yes, I know about those provisions, but where does it say that examination has to occur prior to zoning rather than in a resident's consent?
Well, I did allude to that additional wording that is set out in the purpose statement, but I would, I guess, highlight the direction provided for in Chapter 3 or 4 in regard to that matter is possibly stronger than that provided in Chapter 28 in regard to the understanding of natural hazards and when considering urban development or locating urban growth boundaries.
I was going to ask about the same sort of angle. When you look at 28.317, which is 28.316 is not preclude activities, but then 28.317 says, apart from that, restrict activities where the natural hazard risk is intolerable. And when you talk about restricting activities, I interpret that being as much about the zoning provisions as it would be about a particular resource consent. Do you see that? And then that links back to what's intolerable, which goes back to determining significant risk and risk tolerance in the first two policies. Do you see a link there between whether or not one should restrict activities on a site and determining what's intolerable or not through a proper risk assessment?
Yes, that risk assessment hasn't been done, so we can't get to the submitter hasn't provided any information to enable us to get to that point in time, that point in the chapter, which talks about the management of natural hazards. So I guess the 28.31, 28.31A and B, and we haven't got to that point in time because the submitter hasn't undertaken their assessment and hasn't provided any further to rebuttal to evidence in chief, rather, to Mr. Bond's comments, and in the absence of that, in my view, we aren't able to, before applying the zone in that location, an urban zone, which will enable the location of people and built environment in that in this area, and we don't know if it's going to be managed to a level tolerable to the community. So I'm not sure how we can pass that first suite of objectives and policies before we get to the management side of it, which on the face of it might have been able to get there if we were more certain about the actual extent of the risk or the extent of the hazard and then the actual degree of risk. So we don't have that information in order to be able to us to flow through the provisions of Chapter 28. And that is, as I've said before, the intent of Chapter 3 and 4 is to make sure that we're taking into account at least the constraints, including hazards, on urban development.
Chapter 28.
No, so well, Chapter 3 and 4, first off, set out that
Oh, 3 and 4, yeah.
Yeah, so...
So look back at those as well.
Yeah, for sure. There's quite clear direction in there around how urban areas and urban growth boundaries in particular should be located, having regard to the risk posed by natural hazards.
I take your point and Commissioner's point. Is there an argument, because I'm sure the submitter's going to tell us this, that the restrictions that 28.317 envisages could be by way of consent refusal or consent conditions?
Yeah, I don't think that's a desirable mechanism.
That's a different thing. But
yep.
I accept what you say, but the... you're making a choice, and on the face of it, the consent that policy could be implemented either at the zoning point or at the consent or both.
If we understood more the extent of the hazard and its significance, then perhaps at the consent stage we might be able to deal with it. But until such time, I'm not of the opinion that we should be zoning urban land in the absence of a thorough understanding of the extent of risk. And as I've outlined in my rebuttal, it could result in the zoning of sites that in fact may not actually be able to develop or would impose significant restrictions as a result of managing the actual hazard that's present. And that's not desirable for future landowners. It doesn't provide certainty.
Vivid recollection of the desirability of getting in and not rezoning land if we understand natural hazards.
Area of land that is identified on the Drone Cattle Company site, and the picture that's on here, there's been some debate about the amount of land to be rezoned, and it was due to further conversation about the view from the road and how high it goes up the peak, and I was just wondering. You've based your assessment on essentially on that area of land, with this extending further up this escarpment, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I just need some clarity on what we're actually, and I don't know where that comes from, and I defer to the chair.
Considered the proposal in the light of Mr. Gibbons' evidence as to how he proposes to reduce the areas rezoned compared to the relief originally sought in the submission?
Yes, I have. And Mr. Jones has considered that also, which I have endorsed his views on that. But despite the reduction in the scale of the zoning, my view is that I'm still opposed to it, opposed to the zoning. So I have taken into account.
Thank you. Just one question from me, but it's a bit more general, probably. What have you had discussions with Padrona Cattle Company Limited and Mr. Giddens on what they're actually, what they really want? I know they're asking for the zone, but is there something underneath it? Because when I read the evidence in your rebuttal, and, you know, essentially trying to drop the activity status of some things down, the offensive trade license type activities and the commercial recreation, is it that they have something in mind, do you think? Or are they looking for the zone and will be marketed as a general industrial zone?
There's nothing to suggest that from the evidence that they've submitted. And
no,
I haven't had discussions
with them. We don't know. Well, I need to ask them. So
yeah,
there hasn't been an ongoing dialogue about where this is all heading.
No, from as far as I know, they're seeking the full industrial zone with those slight changes that they're proposing in their evidence.
Just one question, and it follows on from I think the legal submissions from Ms. Scott. I mean, from your understanding of the Cardrona Cattle Company submission, is there anything in there that provides the basis for applying an urban growth boundary around this site?
No, I don't believe so. I know that the Mr. Giddens does talk to that in his evidence in chief as opposed to his submission. But
yes, I'm meaning to go back. You haven't had have you had a good look at the submission and can, from your opinion, confirm one way or the other what the submission says about that?
I'd like to have a look at that if it's possible.
Right,
it's just come
Scott
back to you.
Said it in
yes.
Legal submissions, but
sure.
Quite prepared evidence.
I've
that.
Assessed the application of an urban growth boundary on the basis that it
yes,
would
I
be
know
required.
That.
Yeah.
I'm just asking from your planning analysis of the submission, what's your opinion? And you haven't done that.
Well,
in terms of whether or not it provides scope.
Whether it provides scope, mm. Yeah. No, I defer to Ms. Scott on her opinion on that and would support it. But nonetheless, I have assessed the application of an urban growth boundary on the basis that it would be necessary. Whether that's within scope or of the submission is, I guess, a different question. Yeah.
Mm. All right, thank you.
Commissioner Swin?
Yes.
Commissioner
Murray?
Well, that's the first one down.
Just to be clear, there aren't any questions on the station at Waitere, submission 2357, before we move on?
No.
Excellent. Okay, so let's turn now to the Tussock Rise submission 3128. I'll ask Ms. Hapson first to read her paragraph.
Yep. So just reading from paragraph 9 of my summary of evidence, I do not support the Breen Construction et al. And Tussock Rise Limited submissions for business mixed use zone or similarly permissive outcomes in place of general industrial zone west of Valentine Road. The economic benefits of retaining this cohesive industrial area as general industrial zone, including the centrally located greenfield site owned by Tussock Rise Limited, outweigh the economic costs in my view. And just to clarify where my evidence is located, section 16 of my evidence chief on page 85 deals with Tussock Rise. Section 17 of my evidence in chief deals with Breen et al. And rebuttal statement number 1, section 3 deals with rebuttal to Mr. Ballingall's evidence. And that's it.
We also have evidence from Mr. Charles on this site. He is he was on the screen, he's just popped off the screen quite new. we'll just hand up his highlight summary while we wait for him to come back on.
Probably have, but I'm busy enough to look for it.
Take questions of Ms. Hampson, then go to Dr. Charles.
Certainly,
sorry. And unless you prefer to.
No, I was.
Take a good doctor. He can get the vibe.
Perfect.
I think just hold it still. Paragraph 3.2, Ms. Hampson, of your rebuttal evidence, you're talking about Mr. Ballingall's evidence saying that he's only assessed the Tussock Rise land rather than the wider land. Does that suggested to me that the conclusions he draws based on that limited section are conservative, that if he was looking more widely, then there might be more question, but because he's taken a subset of the wider industrial area, do you think that's correct? Am I correct in that understanding?
Yes, I think he's analysed one site and the rezoning of that site in isolation of the wider submission. So I've tried to set out in my evidence in chief the implications of incrementally the changes that have been requested through that submission. So yes, I think you start to have a greater risk of eroding the capacity of industrial capacity if you considered all of the rezoning requests.
Your rebuttal. Is it putting it too high to say unregulated markets do not produce outcomes or may not? Or something in between? Probably do not.
I think the position of the RMA is that they do not. There's always room for improvement on that, but I think that's the safest position to assume.
Thank you, that's all I had. Commissioner Dawson?
No, I don't have any additional questions.
The Hill? Mr. McLeod?
Just one question with regard to your evidence in chief in 17.5. You reviewed the original data from the council office. Council, those 16 offices are made up as follows, and you provide a list of the office activities. Was that a physical review or a desktop review?
No, that was looking at the more detailed data sitting behind the council's ground truthing. So I had access to the full files that had the list of the businesses that were summarised in graphs throughout Mr. Place's evidence and elsewhere in my evidence. So then it was matching those business names with activities.
Thank you.
Questions?
Oxford. Commissioner Munro.
No, thank you.
Well, looks like we bring in Dr. Charles at this point if he's... He is there.
Excuse me, Mr. Charles has just asked that we speak quite loudly so that he can hear the questions for us.
We'll try and do that.
So, hello, Mr. Charles. Can you hear me?
That's a good start.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear very faintly, but I think I'm listening through the laptop microphone, so anyone who's any distance from that microphone or behind us, it's very broken.
Is that better? No? Okay. Okay, Mr. Charles has, this is for the benefit of the panel, filed one statement of evidence. It's the rebuttal brief. He has addressed this Tussock Rise site. He has also addressed the Corbridge Estate site. I wonder if for convenience, if you have any questions on his evidence on Corbridge, we deal with that now, so we don't have to get Mr. Charles back on Zoom this afternoon, but I'll leave that in your hands. Stephen, can you please read out your summary for Tussock Rise?
I'm sorry, I can't make out what you're saying. It's too...
We all said it once. One, two, three.
Has he got a cell phone?
Can you hear anything?
No. Okay. While we sort that out, why don't we turn to the transport evidence for this?
Okay.
Does anyone have any questions? I don't have any questions.
Yes, I do.
No, I think it's the chair.
Yes, we'll sort that out. So.
I can hear the commissioners better than the council. I presume they're in front of the laptop rather than behind.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Would you like to read out your
summary?
Certainly. I've commented on two submissions. The first by Tussock Rise Limited, my paragraph one. Tussock Rise is seeking to rezone part of my Gent and Duffield zone to business mixed use zone. In my opinion, from an acoustic perspective, that rezoning will constrain industrial activity on adjacent sites remaining in the general industry. There are no proposed district plan noise limits between sites in the general industrial zone, but there are limits that apply to noise from activity in the hidden industrial zone received in other zones. The absence of a noise limit in the general industrial zone is a deliberate step to enable efficient establishment and operation of industrial activity.
And could you please carry on and read your Corbridge summary too?
No. I've finished paragraph two. The last sentence there was, this approach works best in a larger general industrial zone where sites are generally adjacent to other general industrial zone sites. My paragraph three, down insulation and ventilation controls in a business use zone would not alter the noise limits imposed on adjacent general industrial zone activity. And those controls would only partially address potential noise limits. Turning to the Corbridge Estates Limited Partnership submissions, Corbridge Estate is seeking to rezone part of the rural zone to rural visitor zone. This area is in the vicinity of Wanaka Airport. To establish new extensive activities in the rural zone within a noise control boundary around Warnocker Airport. This control is based on a noise envelope or bucket, which includes an allowance for growth of the airport and changes to aircraft types. Current activity at the airport is less than what can be accommodated by allowance. But in my opinion, land use controls for new sensitive activity should be based on within the control boundary. In my opinion, the existing prohibited activity status for sensitive activities in the Warnocker Airport should be replicated in area.
Thank you, Dr. Charles. Turn around to see if you can see me, or I can see you. I just wanted to ask you, please, make sure I understand your reasoning at paragraph 3.3. As I understand what you're saying, it's that if some or all of the former ODP industrial B land were rezoned, that would mean there was a noise limit applying at that boundary where formerly there was none, which in turn will produce greater restrictions on what is currently industrial A land. Have I got that right?
Yes. Under the Watford District Plan, an anomaly, noise from the B zone isn't restricted going into the A zone, but noise from the A zone is restricted going into the B zone. So, in my mind, it must just be a drafting oversight. I can't think of an effect reason why that should exist. But in terms of literal application of that rule, there is currently a noise limit. So the point made by Dr. Trevathan is that you replace that noise limit with the business mixed use zone noise limit, and it's not that big a change. And from that literal interpretation, it's correct. From a practical interpretation, it doesn't. Under the operative district plan, when you look at the outcomes for the industrial B's, if someone was applying to breach that, you'd have a good term for breach. Whereas under there's a different range of more sensitive activity envisaged. So,
and the second question I have related to your 3.8, where you are saying that the noise insulation wouldn't be adequate to protect from heavier industrial activities. The evidence we've heard in your absence has been that there is nothing or very few, quote, heavy, unquote, industries, and that the industry that has established in the Wanaker area and is likely to continue to establish in the Wanaker area is at the lighter end of the spectrum between light and heavy industry. Does that cause you to reconsider your point, accepting that that's the evidence of others that you haven't heard? But if you take that working assumption, where does that take you in terms of your opinion?
So my evidence is independent. In terms of what sort of this zone, my evidence stands. It simply says if you're trying to do these activities, this is the effect they have on adjacent activities. So it's up to the planners to figure out what activities they want to make. What I would say though, when I talk about maybe industrial activities, anything involving a loading bay trying to work 24 hours a day or during the district plan nighttime period, that would struggle to meet the noise. Or even a piece of cooling or fairly standard equipment, you can design it to meet the noise limit, it imposes additional cost. All of those existing activities in the industrial A zone, over time, there will always be change and always be sort of minor alterations to activity. And every time they do that, they impose costs on it. And that holds true for warehouses and lighter activities, as well as, I accept, I'm not aware of any sort of, you know, heavy manufacturing. But the issue is still there. In terms of what activities want to allow for in this zone, I'm away from those discussions.
So basically, your opinion is not dependent on it being heavy. There'll be enough noise sources even in a lighter industrial zone to create an issue based on those insulation standards.
If the lighter industrial includes the warehousing, the loading bays, which I assume it does. So until you tick into a situation where you're predominantly offices or so forth in a more business park environment, well, you've got that goods and movements and so forth, then you've always got those more processes that are likely to be constrained.
Thank you, Dr. Charles. That's all the questions I have. I didn't have any questions on your Corbridge evidence. Commissioner Smith?
No questions, thank you.
Commissioner Munro?
No, you've asked my question.
Not for me.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Charles. That's all we had for you. We appreciate you zooming in. And
thank you for accommodating me remotely. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we'll now turn to the transport evidence for the Tussock Rise site.
For reference, the comments on the Tussock Rise are in the rebuttal evidence of Mr. Smith, dated 12th of June. But in summary, the submission fails to identify the potential effects of the rezoning on the surrounding land use connections and the likely traffic impacts that could move through the zone. The submission also fails to address safe routes, movement of children and non-motorised users to and from the town centre and Three Park Zone.
So could you tell me again which rebuttal brief it was, what date?
12th of June.
12th of June. There's who we are.
Begins page 7.
Yep. Commissioner Smith?
No questions.
Commissioner Munro? Mr. Dawson?
I found it difficult to understand why this was relevant to it. Change from a general industrial zone, which is what I understand Tussock Rise wants to go back to, a business mixed use zone. Would not both those zones have to take account of the impact of the through movement through that zone?
The concern that we've got is more to do with the residential development could have with the BMU type zone that you wouldn't get with industrial zoning. In each case, one of the things that doesn't come through very clearly with the various land zoning, particularly in the wider whichever route becomes the preferred route, there will need to be improvements on those routes to provide for cyclists or additional footpaths. So it's sort of discussed briefly, but it's not made clear how that would be addressed going forward, who would be responsible for putting all of that infrastructure in place.
But even if it was a general industrial zone, the movement of traffic from the residential areas to the west and south would at some stage need to be addressed through Frederick or Gordon. But what is the additional issue that comes out of that area being zoned, being new, which has a residential or visitor accommodation component?
I think the additional one is BMU think you'd expect more smaller businesses, so a higher number of driveways, some more conflicts with footpaths. In the submission, there is some discussion about road design and perhaps some sort of control to stop industrial vehicle movements travelling through the adjacent residential area, but that wouldn't stop the residential traffic moving back through the industrial zone. And if I look at where the zoning that's proposed in three parks, for example, or even with the school, the site, there will be a demand for school children to travel through those areas. So there's going to be a need to look at safe routes at some stage. So at the moment, it's just our view that it hasn't been discussed in the submission to a sufficient level of detail to say that it makes sense.
Thank you.
Is that it?
That's it, thank you. Yeah.
Mr. Hill? Mr. McLeod?
Not for me, thanks.
Okay. Next. Mr. Powell?
Mr. Place.
What's this?
Mr. Place.
Mr. Place.
Oh, yes, sorry, I didn't pull up your crib sheet. Who had? We're interested in this. So we're up to Mr. Place.
Tussock Ryers et al. Seek that their vacant land in Wanaka, as well as a number of already developed properties in the wider area, be rezoned from general industrial zone to business mixed use zone. The vacant land, subject to the submission, is strategically located and ideally suited to accommodating future general industrial zone development in Wanaka. Its close proximity to already developed general industrial zone land and the commercial core of three parks will enable an efficient and effective development of land and operation of industrial and service activities. If granted, the relief would result in the loss of general industrial zone land and the introduction of a zoning framework incompatible with the range of existing industrial and service activities in this area. It would also result in the introduction of non-industrial and service activities to the detriment of those existing activities in this location which serve Wanaka's industrial economy. And in terms of the location of so I talked to Tussock Ryers' submission at paragraph 8.3 to 8.17 of my evidence in chief and section 9 of my first rebuttal.
Looking at paragraph 11, or 8.11, you make the point that the land is surrounded to the north, east and south with largely developed industrial and service activities. I think the query I had is whether it's also surrounded by offices and retail operations, and that it's adjoined, get my directions right, prior to the west by residential activities.
So the majority of activities within the Wanaka General Industrial Zone are industrial, or service activities. And in terms of the residential type zones, they are buffered through the use of building restriction areas, which have been brought over from the operative district plan. So the only low density residential zone is to the sort of southwest.
So the only what?
So the only low density residential zone is to the southwest.
Consequences of the rezoning sought, would it follow if it were rezoned BMU that it that the existing buffer to the residential areas to the west would no longer be required?
I think it would possibly be useful to keep them, because I believe part of it, the application of the building restriction areas in that location was for visual screening and separation. But I haven't assessed the in detail the reason for keeping the building restriction areas, and if a BMUZ were to be applied, but it would be useful in my view.
I think when earlier, I'm not sure it was you that he was asking, but Commissioner Smith asked about mounding. So is there a physical barrier as well as a BRA to the west?
So the variations to Chapter 27 manage that the development of the building restriction, well, the not the development of the building restriction area, but the formation of them in terms of landscaping, and in particular, there is some small sort of increase in the height of that the building restriction areas in terms of mounding, but I wouldn't say that it's creates a significant physical barrier. The barrier, in my view, more comes from the absence of building in that location. But there are provisions built into Chapter 27 which manage how the boundary interacts with the surrounding residential zones.
Thank you, Mr. Place. Commissioner McLeod?
And nothing from me, sir.
Mr. Hill?
Thank you.
Mr. Dawson?
No.
Right.
No, thank you. Yeah, a couple of quick questions. One is, you referred to that the adjoining activities as being industrial in character, but your evidence also says that, I think, and I'm sorry, I don't have the number in front of me, but 40-something percent of them wouldn't be permitted under the proposed general industrial zone. Is that correct?
I'd have to refer back to my Section 32 report, which identifies the proportion of that Section 32 report, which identifies proportions of activities.
I suppose the question is, keeping that in mind, is it industrial in character?
So at 7.34, I deal with the ground truthing in the Section 32 report, and identify in the Wanaka industrial zone that 23.4% of activities are light industrial, 5.2% are industrial, 20% are office, and 29.9% of service activity, and then the industrial. So there's a, in my view, it is industrial character, and then.
Mr. Place, can you just give us a cumulative figure between industrial and non-industrial, if you can add them in your head?
Oh, yeah, I do actually. So at paragraph 7.35 and 7.36, I talk to the mix, and if you don't mind, I'll just read off some of those paragraphs, if that's okay. I say that service activities are the most common type of predominant activity, comprising 29.9.
An approximation is fine.
Yeah, that's there, thank you.
It's greater than 50. It's probably about almost 60. Perhaps Ms. Hanson.
Thank you.
So it might be 60-40.
Yeah, that's correct.
Sorry, Commissioner.
No problem. Can you just comment on the impacts on potential building heights? Because I'm aware that the business mix zone has a 12 metre height limit now, is that correct? And that where the industrial, general industrial has a lower height limit?
General industrial has a 10 metre height limit.
A 10 metre height limit versus a 12 metre height limit. Okay.
I think there are, yeah, I'll just feel free to keep questioning, but I'll just double check what the BMUs, because there is a greater height limit in the Queenstown BMUZ. So I'll just double check that, though.
Yeah, thank you. And just the only other question is that the land in question, the Tussock Rise land, is somewhat elevated. It's a little bit higher than the surrounding land, and it sort of sits on top of a bit of a knoll. Have you considered that, the elevation at all, in your recommendation?
Yes, so the... the building restriction areas that have been incorporated and brought over from the operative district plan, in my view, would be sufficient in dealing with any potential visual effects from the already urban enabled land. So the building height in that location was 7 metres going to 10. I'm not of the view that that would be material in terms of the nature of the effect of building height.
And sorry, just one final question. Is the height limit in the former industrial B zone the same as the height limit in the general industrial zone proposed?
No, the industrial B zone provides for 7 metres. The industrial B zone provides for 7 metres and the general industrial zone provides for 10 metres. So there is an increase. There are some locations in the industrial B zone on the Tussock Rise site that have variable height limits. They're called special areas. They're very small, confined areas that have much lower height limits. But that certainly is... not representative of the wider site in terms of how it would be developed. It's very, very confined, those areas that have lower height limits under the industrial B zone in the Tussock Rise site.
Sorry, have they been carried through into the general industrial?
They haven't.
And if so, did you consider that, and is there scope to put height limits on the industrial, general industrial provisions on that site?
Yes, so I as discussed previously, the areas that are subject to those building restriction, building height limits, additional building height limits, are so confined that I'm not sure of I don't believe that would be an effective or efficient use of that land, and they're actually located sort of away from the boundaries of the site with the residential land anyhow. So.
Thank you.
What are we up to next?
back to the section 42A on page 74, the submission by Willow Ridge. So this relates to two small areas, which is shown in figure 5 of Mr. Place's section 42A report on page 76. The first area Mr. Place recommends that the rezoning be accepted. The second he recommends being rejected. There might be some questions on that small area. I understand that Willow Ridge didn't address that site in the evidence, but I'll leave that to you. There is nothing in the summary on this.
Ms. Hampson and Mr. Place.
Ms. Hampson's evidence was essentially heard yesterday because her evidence focuses on the three parks area.
So we just need to concern ourselves with Mr. Place.
Correct.
Commissioner Smith. I had a discussion yesterday with Mr. Mathey as to whether correction of the supposed mapping error that you discuss at 8.11 qualifies as a minor change, and he's gone away to think about that. If it's not a minor change and we don't have scope to change it, what does that, what impact does that have on your analysis?
I still am of the opinion that the zoning is the most appropriate for the site. In spite of that, it does create slight awkwardness in terms of the way that piece of land is going to be used in association with the parcel that it's actually associated with, so because it's not going to be developed for industrial land on the basis that it's too small and narrow, as was discussed yesterday. So it shouldn't impact the rest of the site, or it wouldn't impact my view on the rest of the site being appropriate for a general industrial zone. It would need to be corrected in due course if it wasn't going to be. It's most likely that it would need to be corrected in due course if it wasn't a Core 16.
Can you tell me what the distance is between that access point and boundary that Willow Ridge are seeking to rezone to? I know it's not I can see from your figure 8 that it's not a single distance because the two boundaries are sloped relative to each other, but what approximate distance, average distance, would that be?
Sorry, I'll just find it on my computer here. So you're talking about the distance in of area 2, from the boundary to the boundary, the northern boundary of area 2, is that correct?
I think, yes, I'm not sure the distance, but we're on figure 8, Willow Ridge is suggesting that the interface between GIEZ and MDA.
Sure. I can do a very rough measurement on my computer here, rather than me guessing.
Essentially, my what lies behind my question is that strange shape a usable size?
So it's about 100. If I'm interpreting your question correctly, the distance is about 120 metres potentially on the boundary along Riverbank Road. Obviously, at the where it.
And it narrows from that.
Yes. And then,
so the follow-up question is that shape, that square of land, a usable industrial site?
In terms of its area, it's not, I would have to work out what the metres squared is, but it may be able to be subdivided to create a small number of lots, but it wouldn't produce a significant or material number of lots. But it would generate some.
Thank you, Mr. Place. Next one.
Okay, so Papakutha Transport, submission 3256. Ms. Hampson?
I support the submission, and I've addressed this in section 13 of my evidence in chief, which starts on page 70. And I just add to that I understand that Mr. Place has agreed or suggested a rural industrial overlay in place of a general industrial zone, and I would support that based on the intent of my evidence.
Commissioner McLeod.
This is a question from Ms. Hanson?
Yes.
Negative.
No, I think I asked you a question yesterday. I know it wasn't strictly in relation to school zoning, but my question would have been exactly the same, which is, I think we were talking before about consolidation. This is a single site, but your answer to that was this is essentially to provide for a particular activity.
Yes, to a transfer of an activity to a more sustainable site. Yep.
Right, and on that basis you thought it was acceptable from an economic perspective.
Yes.
Thank you.
No.
Thanks for clarifying your support of Mr. Place's recommendation. I don't recall off the top of my head whether the submission offered any legal guarantees that it would only undertake the transfer of what's use that you've assessed. If the land was just accepted for rezoning and the owner undertook some other activity that the zone provides for, are you still equally comfortable?
You're right, I'm not sure that there was any guarantee that they would transfer their operations, although I believe that was the understanding. Yes, I am still comfortable with that because there is an existing industrial buildings on both ends of that site and it would be a logical place to join those together.
Thank you.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. Following on from that question, keeping in mind, I suppose, that the Upper Clutha Transport activity was established in the township zone and now what it will become a settlement zone, I understand. Did you make an assessment of the scale of that activity in terms of, I'm just looking at Mr. Edgar's evidence, who's suggesting that provisions for the Upper Clutha Transport site would allow for 25,000 square metres of industrial ground floor area, which by any measure is substantial. I mean, I think I understand that Mitre 10 Mega is 7 or 8,000 square metres, so it would effectively allow more than three Mitre 10 Mega building structures to be located on that site. Is that what you anticipated in your assessment?
It may be worth checking with Mr. Edgar if he was referring to built space or if he was referring to the footprint of the land that they would require. I know the current site doesn't have a lot of built buildings on it. It's mostly yard-based activities. So, but yeah, no, I think even if it was to sustain built floor area, I would still be comfortable with that.
Okay, I might ask a similar question to Mr. Place as well. Is that appropriate to do that now?
No, just hold that.
Okay, thank you. That's all for you, thank you.
I have no questions, so that's Mr. Jones.
So, in relation to Upper Clifford Transport, I do not oppose the GIZ or Rural Industrial Subzone Relief Resort, subject to the refinement of the provisions related to building restriction areas and the requirement for planting along their respective site boundaries. The recommended BRA building restriction area and planting will provide visual softening and a buffer and a setback to future built form anticipated within the site and to those adjacencies, including the setback and buffer to the Clutha River and identified ONF. And on the ONF point, I must clarify that within my evidence in chief and within my rebuttal statement, I referred to that as an ONL, and I understand from Ms. Scott that through topic two, the Clutha River has been identified as an ONF. So that's within section six of my, well, they're both section six of evidence in chief and rebuttal evidence. And a further point, through further consideration during the time since which my rebuttal evidence was issued, I consider that the rural industrial subzone to be a more appropriate zone for this site, and that's relating back to I still recommend the building restriction areas and planting within that setback irrespective, but it's more related to the wall control that the council has in relation to future built form on the site. Which, sorry, I specifically say it's related to building design, external appearance, the size, which is ground floor area, and height.
First of all, can I just clarify which do you deal with this in your rebuttal evidence? So which one?
Oh, I'm sorry. That is the first statement of rebuttal. Sorry, should have clarified that.
I have two related questions. There's a policy in Chapter 6 related to visibility of development from public spaces, and my understanding is that the Clutha River Trail qualifies as a public space from this at this location because it's on Crown land, not on private land. How visible will it be, given the BRA that's been proffered over the old landfill?
I personally have not been along the Clutha River Trail. However, it was my intention to try and provide a setback, which would provide that, to restrict that visibility. That's kind of the point of the BRA and the setback that I was intending. And then with appropriate planting within that margin that would go some way to buffer that particular edge in relation to visibility. This is looks to be 6.3.4.6. Will it be highly visible from that trail? Without having been to the site, I can't pass a comment on that. But as I stated, I endeavoured to provide a buffer to that edge in relation to potential visibility.
Ms. Scott, I think it would be helpful, given that that's the direction from Chapter 6, that by your reply, Mr. Jones has been to the site and can proffer an opinion. Second, the second half of that policy requires that adverse effects on visual amenity be avoided where they form the foreground for an O&L or O&F when viewed from public roads. Have you thought about the view from Church Road out to the Grandview Mountains? The impression I got when we were on our site visit, because our guide had a GPS, was that the views out over the site would be retained by the BRA, but the question is, have you considered whether that is correct, given that the policy is quite directive?
Which policy is that?
6.3.4.6 in the version that's is in the process of emerging from the court.
Sorry, yes, I've now read it. So what was the specific question?
Will this site sit in the foreground of the view of the O&Ls in the background? As I say, the impression I had was that if the BRA was built on, it would. But I'm not sure about this land. It may be far enough down the road that it's not in the foreground of view of the mountains behind, but that's the question for you.
Yes. So that was not the specific intention of the BRA, but that will go some way to assist in that, reducing any obstruction of the view towards their mountain range. I do note that the existing site is covered in pine, which is already screening any visibility, but that's not protected, so it could be removed at any time.
I think the working assumption is that if Upper Perth Transport create a massive yard on that land, everything's going to get flattened.
Yes.
You can point me to a protected pine, that would be interesting.
I was nowhere suggesting it's protected. I think there will be an element of the built form in the view towards those mountains. When you're looking along Church Road, the range is evident. With a 20-metre buffer back, you're creating more of visibility along that edge. But then, as you're turning towards the north, that visibility may become obstructed by future built form at the scale that's anticipated by these zones.
Is that in the same category? You'd need to go and have a look.
If I'm going out there, I would obviously take this into account. But
can I ask you to do that and to give us a definite view on that point? Commissioner Smith.
Yeah, thank you. And similar question to what we touched on before, and I note in Mr. Place's evidence in his response, he actually refers to the 25,000 square metre thing as being highly restrictive. I just wonder whether you've considered the impact of a building of that scale or buildings of that scale on that site. And I have confirmed that in the proposed rules it does refer to ground floor area of buildings as opposed to activities.
Yes. I hadn't anticipated it in the literal metrics, but I had looked at thought about it in the scale of the site, and that's why my leaning is now stronger towards that rural industrial subzone, which has a more restrictive building coverage than would be anticipated by the GIZ. When you're looking at within the context of this particular site, you've got the deer processing and the sawmill to the south, which is currently rural industrial subzone. And future buildings within the rural industrial subzone in this site would be arguably of a similar scale as opposed to the, I believe you said, 25,000 square that a GIZ could allow for.
Okay, and our chair has touched on the impact of higher order policies on the assessment in the rural area for this activity. And I just wonder if we look at it from the other perspective too, if we have a subzone within the rural zone to allow for such activities, is there a landscape conflict in there between the policies in the rural zone and the rules and policies and activities that would be provided by such a subzone?
No, because the rules within that subzone go quite a way to in order to protect the or maintain and enhance the landscape attributes of the site. So that's in relation to external appearance, visual prominence, character. So it's not precluding any form future form within the sites as a prohibited activity. It's just saying if it's going to happen, it needs to happen in these sorts of way. So that's what the standards are trying to achieve. And that's a
Okay, and are you aware of any situation where those activities are provided in the rural zone among the rules, or in from a landscape perspective?
Can you ask the question again, too?
So are you aware of any situation in this district where activities, non-rural activities, for want of a better term, of this scale have been provided for in that zone? And justified from a landscape perspective.
Are you talking about specifically the GIZ?
Yeah. Well, this subzone that's been proposed through the rural subzone.
The land immediately to the south is rural industrial subzone currently, which is the deer processing in the sawmill. And so that has its own characteristics, but it's not of a inappropriate character within the site, because what the subzone activities are trying to do is provide for rural related industrial activities. So in this context and the scale of the site, I don't feel that that's inappropriate as an example.
Are you aware of what the scale of those existing activities are in terms of the ground floor area?
No, I'm not sure, sir.
Thank you.
Follow up question for me. Just thinking that is there an issue with such a large area of the site being taken up by a BRA that the site coverage limit is effectively meaningless because there's such a large balancing lot, so that you could get quite intensive development of the remaining area?
I don't think there is a site coverage limit.
Well, that might be a good answer.
There's a maximum size per building of 500 square metres.
That's in the RISZ.
Yes, that's
but
what
then in the GIZ there's a 75% coverage limit.
Yeah.
So that might
that's
be
the, that's the 25,000 square metres.
Exactly.
Mm.
But to order, answer your question, Mr. Chair, I had taken that into account because the BRA that I've suggested provides an edge to the Church Road and the Clutha River boundaries, and then the BRA which the submitter has provided is within the northern portion where the landfill used to be, so it actually contains the development, future opportunity for development further to the south. And in my opinion, that's actually more appropriate because it contains it closer to what is the existing industrial use to the south, as opposed to spreading it more up along Church Road, admittedly within this site.
Sorry, Commissioner Monroe.
Thank you.
Commissioner Dawson. Yes, so I'm just going to dive into some rules here, because first of all, you've said that you think the RI subzone is a more appropriate zone than the general industrial zone because it provides a greater level of control of the built form. I think that's what you said. Is that right? So you mentioned building design, building coverage and height. So I just want to make sure you're correct here, because I'm just looking at it. From what I can see, buildings are permitted in this zone, but with controls over exterior surface colours and materials. Whereas in the GIZ, as I understand it, buildings are restricted discretionary.
They're both restricted discretionary and both.
No, you're only restricted discretionary if you don't meet the standard for exterior surface colours in the RISZ, because that's a standard, and the activity status is where you don't meet it. Isn't that right?
I believe that buildings are restricted discretionary.
In the RISZ. No, they're not. Are they permitted?
That's my interpretation.
They're permitted. Is that your interpretation?
No. My interpretation is that they're a restricted discretionary activity, and there are standards there, which is slightly awkward, I agree. Think is what you're getting at.
Well, if you look down to the next rule, which is building size, and it says the ground floor area of any building must not exceed 500 square metres. So that's any one building.
Sorry.
Then it says RD.
Yeah. You're correct, actually. So
I think I am correct.
Yeah, 2113.4 buildings for, as long as they're for rural industrial activities.
They're permitted.
As long as they comply with Table 11. Yes, that's correct.
That's right.
Apologies, my mistake.
So, I mean, to me, the building... And you can have hundreds of 500 square metre buildings, or as many as you can, to fill up that site. They wouldn't probably have even 75% coverage, but you could have a lot of buildings because it is a big site. And as long as they're all under 500 square metres, they would be permitted as well.
50 square metres.
Yes, I don't know whether that's right. So how do you say that the RIZ provides greater control over built form than the GIZ?
Well, I was under the impression with your conversation with Mr. Place that it was a restricted discretionary activity. So now that it is permitted, I would be suggesting that we would need to impose a building design or external appearance provision.
Okay, well, that was my next series. That was going to be my original series of questions until I heard what you just said. So you already, in your evidence, even when you said it was restricted discretionary, have a series of requirements which include these buffer areas, but you don't just require them to be empty of buildings and outdoor storage. You also require them to have a landscape treatment. You think they should have some sort of landscape treatment on them, is that correct?
Yes, correct.
And that they should be 20 metres wide, so we need to make sure there's a rule that says that. And there needs to be a rule that says that not only buildings, but say outdoor storage and equipment and machinery storage is not
Yes, and that's
correct?
A point that you asked Mr. Place earlier this morning.
Which seems to be covered up in the GIZ, but not in this other zone.
But is it not, I'm looking towards Luke with a quick clarification, but is it not, being a BRA, the same non-complying activity within the rural industrial subzone?
I don't know. That's what
I'm
asked Mr. Place then.
Yeah, I was under the impression that was the case.
Okay, and also you're also saying you want the building setback from on the Clutha River side to be from the ONF,
yes,
not from the site boundary.
Yes.
So have you had discussions with Mr. Place about how all that's going to be implemented in whichever zone it ends up being?
No, not specifically, but it was more my from a landscape point of view, the protection of that ONF, as well as the other
all
the other matters.
And now
that
we've
got
building design added to that list as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so you and Mr. Place haven't yet got together and worked out how that would happen.
Not specifically. It's not that this is drastically different, but the area that of ONF which falls into the site is. It's almost like a.
That's just a small thing. I'm just saying, you've now got four or five requirements that you think are necessary for the site to be acceptable from a landscape point of view. All my question is, have you, the landscape treatment, the buffer width, the outdoor storage, just four buildings in those buffers, that you've got building design covered, da da da. All I'm saying is, have you and Mr. Place, or have you been assured by Mr. Place that those rules are in place in his recommendations?
We have had numerous conversations on these points.
Mm. Where have you got?
But in terms of is there assurance, I don't have that currently.
Not yet. All right. Well, then Mr. Place can answer the same question in a minute. Thank you.
Just as my question was that, as someone that cycles that track a lot, and you do go, I take the point that there's industrial below and industrial above, but I question 20 metres and scope and scale, is that enough given the that is part of what is about to become a national trail? In your opinion, is 20 metres enough?
My current thinking is yes, it is.
Given we've got 50 square metre buildings, and if you carry on down, and I'll have a conversation with you after you've been to the site, probably makes a bit more sense, but if you carry on down to the Wallace's Place, which is the deer processing facility, and it's much, in terms of scale, it's smaller scale, that is quite highly visible, as is the sawmill, which is further up. So I perhaps just pose the question, and we'll re-ask it when you visit the site.
I don't think you'll get a chance to be a written reply, Commissioner.
And potentially
now
maybe
it's
you
now
can
or
reflect
never
on it and write in your written reply. In the
And just in reference to the 20 metres, the topography of the area, the trail's set down slightly, and the topography of the area does peter away. So in terms of angle of view, when you're pushing back 20 metres, that perspective depth does push, but I will be able to clarify that point within a statement.
It peters away from where to where?
From the
trail to the road? Or?
Oh, sorry. I'm literally talking from the edge of the site to... from the trail up to the site. And then within the site, it levels off because largely, arguably, the site is relatively level topography.
If you look at the
trail
direction, that photograph, which has got the site on it,
yes,
the trail comes past and basically starts to peter away just about here.
Yeah,
it's well after the site. You've actually cycled past it before it drops off, and the site is relatively flat across. So in terms of view from Church Road and from trail is quite a similar impact.
However, Commissioner, let's let Mr. Jones stroll down that path and enjoy the view.
Take a bike.
Of the site.
Don't end up on the river.
One further question, just on to the discussion about the setbacks. If 20 metres, and this is something, again, possibly to consider for the written reply, if 20 metres isn't enough, what does that do? Because it is a, using the photograph again, an L-shaped, it fattens out towards the sawmill end. What does that do to the viability of that end?
To the northern end?
To the northern end.
Well, that's that whole site, that whole portion of the site is a building restricted area anyhow.
The entirety?
The northern portion of the site is identified. That's where the submitter has suggested building a building restriction area. Because that's the former landfill.
Yeah, it is. It's a hill site, I do believe. Yep. Thank you for clarifying that for me. I have no further questions.
On to we have Mr. Ross then. Cannot forget him.
I think I can be fairly quick on this. Our concern really arises from the questions that have been raised about the 25,000 square metres of development. It was our understanding at the moment that there is no control that limits development to that level. And we have earlier been talking about potential building coverage of 75% in the industrial zone, which would suggest potentially three times as much development, given 25,000 represents 27% coverage. So the analysis that's been done on traffic potentially underestimates what could happen with the site, and therefore the extent of road network improvements that might be required. And then the wider effects on the state highway as well, which haven't been addressed. Now, I would accept that it may not be practical and there may never be a demand for that level of development, but if you zone straight as industrial, there needs to be a control against that.
Commissioner Smith.
Yeah, thank you for that. Have you had any engagement with NZTA on their, is it a limit access highway?
I haven't been involved, unless I didn't prepare the original evidence, but I don't believe we've had any discussions with NZTA on this.
Okay. That's all, thank you.
Commissioner Rowe.
Just like my questions of Mr. Jones, have you had the chance to have any discussions with Mr. Place about how those controls might be put into place, or how, what might be a trigger mechanism for the road upgradings that might be needed as the development gets to a certain scale, or those sorts of things?
Given my late involvement, I haven't had opportunity to discuss it, but I'm, as far as I'm aware, I don't believe Mr. Smith had either.
Okay, so that's fine. I'll ask Mr. Place. Thank you.
Mr. Hill? And Commissioner McLeod?
Please, Dan. I'm fine, thank you, sir.
Nothing from me.
Upperquitha Transport Limited seek that the land on the outskirts of Luggett be included within the general industrial zone, or in the alternative within the rural industrial subzone. The application of an urban general industrial zone on the subject land is not supported by the direction set out in Chapter 3 or Chapter 4. The rural industrial subzone is a better fit given the location of the land and its associated constraints. While the application of the rural industrial subzone could be supported, a number of outstanding matters relating to landscape and traffic/transport management alongside the overall appropriateness of the proposed provisions, require further attention before I am able to support a rural industrial subzone in this location.
Okay, once again, Mr. Place, can you identify for me where in your evidence in chief this is?
Yes, so evidence in chief 8, paragraph 8.14 to 8.17, please.
Page 80.
Page 80.
Yep.
Thank you, Sarah. Scott. And first rebuttal, section 9, first rebuttal statement.
You've been obviously been listening to Commissioner Dawson's questions. How much of the flaws, if we might call them that, or the lack of control in the RISZ is explainable by the fact that historically it's only ever applied to one site, being the Wallace Deer Velvet Place in the sawmill. It was written around what was already occurring.
Yeah, so I think it's still a good fit in this instance, given the unique nature of the site, although it may have been written for a particular site, I don't think it excludes it from being applied elsewhere where it's appropriate. Sorry, just correct, in terms of my rebuttal statement, was that section 10 rather than 9? Apologies. That's my first rebuttal statement.
I picked up that you're relying on the fact that RISZ avoids the problems of an urban zone and a rural area. Mr. Edgar observes that council's economic modelling treats the RISZ as part of the urban environment. So first of all, is that correct, and does that create an issue?
Just in terms of the definition of urban development is useful, I think, in this context, and in my view, it wouldn't fit the definition of urban development, the rural industrial
sector. Can you say that more clearly?
Apologies. I was just referencing the definition of urban development and how, in my view, the standards set up in the rural industrial subzone are such that it wouldn't fit the definition of urban development.
Thank you. Commissioner Dawson.
I can add to that if needed. Now, I mean, you've heard my questions of the two witnesses have got the outstanding problems. I don't want to put it all onto you guys. I mean, you're not, the submitter has to come to the party on this as well. So I think for you, within the context of the structure and the way that the subzone is written and formulated, do you think it's possible to deal with these outstanding issues within that zone's provisions? I mean, if someone was to have the inclination to sit down and write a whole lot of rules and perhaps policies for that subzone tailored to the site, is that a possible? Could that possibly occur without sort of undermining the whole structure of this subzone?
I think it could be done. I think you could use possibly. And again, you're right that I think the submitter needs to come to the table with some of these, and I've highlighted that. But a structure plan approach might be useful, and I've sort of alluded to that a little bit in my rebuttal, highlighting the matters that they're trying to address, which I don't think have been sufficiently addressed. But I think that would need to be the mechanism that would need to be used to manage future development on a more comprehensive basis on the site.
Mm.
And it would be able to incorporate in a similar way that it has done in...
the GIZ uses that, doesn't
correct.
It? Mm.
Yeah, so there could be a way through that. It would be complex to try and change the provisions of the rural industrial subzone, but I don't think it's impossible.
It's a quite simple little set of provisions there at the moment, aren't
yes,
they?
Yes, that's correct. You're right, yeah.
I mean, things like you'd have to bring in a building you went along with Mr. Jones's recommendation, I'd have to bring in a new building design control that's not there at the moment. Maybe some overall control over the scale of development in relation to the traffic matters.
Potentially. I mean, I'd like to have a chat with Mr. Jones a bit more through the reply process, if that's possible, about the controls on buildings, but you're right. It is a fairly confined sort of zone at the moment in terms of its policy support as well.
Mm. Yes.
But I don't think it's impossible.
Only just like two little policies
mm.
about that.
Yeah,
mm.
correct.
But to date you haven't had any, the applicant hasn't come to you to discuss any of this to date.
That's
not
correct.
The applicant, the submitter, I mean. Yeah.
That's correct, yeah.
One thing that I was just wondering about the complexity of, as I understand the traffic evidence, there's sort of such a potentially, possibly, large scale of development that could occur on that site. But, it mightn't, or it mightn't happen for years and years.
Sure.
But if it did, then as I understand the traffic evidence, it's suggesting that there would need to be a mechanism for capturing some roading upgrades, maybe even to the state highway. But it's possible there wouldn't be subdivision on that site.
Correct.
If it's all going to be used by Upper Clutha Transport. So there would need to be a land use mechanism for capturing some threshold for consideration of
yes.
of traffic effects and traffic upgrades, etc.
Yes, you're right. And I think the applicant has tried to the submitter has tried to do that through the 25,000. It appears that the 25,000 square metre limit would be related to traffic matters. A traffic effects would be some sort of threshold to try and assess the effects of traffic at that point. And we might come to it, but I'm unclear from the evidence that's been provided from the experts on the submission exactly why the 25,000 was chosen. And
And Mr. Smith and Mr. Roster say that could well be an underestimate of the of when the effects might arise. Yeah.
Yes, and I outline other concerns with that in my rebuttal in terms of who's going to, at what point, and who's going to pay for that, and who's going to be accountable for it, and it sort of only does apply if the site isn't subdivided, and if it doesn't eventuate for multiple users.
Mm.
So there is some unknowns there, which perhaps I think the submitter and their experts might be best placed to answer in terms of future outcomes for the site.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you.
Mr. Smith?
Yeah, thank you. As I touched on before, you made the comment in your evidence that you consider the 25,000 metres significantly restrictive, I think were the words that you used. Do you think that's the case?
Highly restrictive.
Highly restrictive,
yeah.
Sorry.
I think there is a degree of ambiguity in the information that's been provided as to why exactly that is needed. And I am troubled by the fact that we'd be zoning a significant area of land for either an urban, being the GIZ, or a rural industrial subzone use, and at the same time imposing quite significant restrictions on it. It seems like, the best mechanism at plan making stage that we have is to zone the land in a way that's commensurate to its constraints, which would be to avoid and sort of avoid placing restrictions on it that's significant in that way.
So So if I'm to point you towards the rural chapter 21 decisions version, policy 21.2.1.10 says commercial activities in the rural zone should have a genuine link to the rural land or the water resource or farming or horticulture, viticulture, associated with resources located in the rural land. Mm. And I also go down to the policy that directly relates to the rural industrial activities. Provide for rural industrial activities on buildings within established nodes of industrial development while protecting, maintaining, enhancing the landscape and amenity values. Are rural industrial activities the same as industrial activities?
So the definition, chapter 2 does provide a definition of rural industrial activity, and you're right, it does use the same describing words for that are used in industrial definition, but it adds that additional component on the end, which yes, talks about it. It has to be directly related to the rural zone and productive uses. So,
there is a specific definition of rural industrial activity.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Okay, so keeping that in mind, are the Upper Clutha transport activities discreetly rural industrial activities, or are they general industrial activities?
They're suggesting that a rural industrial subzone would be appropriate for the land, and they're suggesting that their intention is to relocate their existing activities into that zone. So I would suggest that they're happy with that.
Are you happy with it, that it's a rural industrial activity as opposed to an industrial activity, a straight industrial activity?
Yeah, having visited the site, I'm aware that they do source their products or the items that they store and sell and distribute from the rural zone. And I'm also aware that they store their materials and machinery, their machinery in particular being the trucks and vehicles that they use to distribute their materials there. So I believe that their current activity would fit within that definition.
Okay. It refers to established nodes of activities, and presumably that would mean that it was intended to cover existing sites that had an existing activity of some degree.
Mm.
Does that policy enable new nodes to be created, and what's a node? How big's a node? When does a node become an area?
Mm. Yeah, so that is, I guess, reflecting on some of the comments from the chair around the application of the zone to an existing uses. It does appear that it talks to established nodes, but I think that in this instance, given there's an existing rural industrial subzone and associated activity directly adjoining the site, I don't think we'd be outside the remit of that policy to place the rural industrial subzone on this adjoining site subject to Upper Clutha Transport's submission.
Do we not have two nodes already identified?
Which two are you referring to? So
the existing activities.
The existing activities. So that's a node, and I believe that we would be almost reinforcing or expanding the node somewhat if the rural industrial subzone was to be placed on the Upper Clutha Transport site.
Raises the question I touched on before: when does a node become an area, precinct, or something else? When does a node move from being a node?
I think that with the relief that's being sought, this would be a node,
okay,
in my view.
Right, and just refer to one other that was touched on by Councillor McLeod, around the effects on the tracks, and I refer to 21.2.116, which is provide for a range of activities that support the vitality, use, enjoyment of the Queenstown Trails and Upper Clutha tracks networks on the basis that landscape, rural amenity is protected, maintained, enhanced, and established activities are not compromised. Is the experience, is the views, is, have you been on that trail, firstly?
I have visited the site and I've seen the location of the trail from the site, yes. And I do believe we did go onto the site, the trail as well. So.
Okay,
one thing that you might take into account, this is not a trail as defined.
When is the trail not a trail?
When is
it's
the trail?
It's part of the Upper Clutha Tracks Network, I would suggest.
Well, there might be a trail. It might be a...
It doesn't require it to be a trail, it just has to be part of the network in this case.
Sorry. Thank you.
Specify both trail and track. And
So it's a track, not a trail.
Yeah. And it says...
What's the difference between Upper Clutha and Wakatepe?
It says Upper Clutha Tracks Network in this case. Sorry.
Thank you for that.
So I'm just trying to establish... Well, firstly, I would encourage both of you to visit the track and respond to that in your written response, because I think it is quite important. And I think this policy, I would be interested to have your view on this policy in light of that visit, and whether the activity protects, maintains and enhances and doesn't compromise the experience of that track.
Do you want me to
please do.
Yeah, so certainly have visited the site and the trail, and I agree that we should be putting a degree of caution around the experience that might be diminished or not from the rural industrial subzone or the general industrial zone on the site. I don't disagree with you, and I think that I highlight some of the concerns, my concerns, with the proposed rules that have been provided from Mr. Edgar, and I think further work needs to be done on the setbacks and the landscaping and the degree to which that is, the proposed methods are effective and efficient. So I share your concerns about the need to make sure that we're being proactive on that matter.
Thank you. I think that, I'm sure that's come across well, to have a look at that provision, those provisions in your response. And the other thing I'd be interested in your response would be whether there's an assessment against the scale of those two existing activities in terms of ground floor area. Those two areas that we have existing, and I would be interested to know what the magnitude of those activities are and how this magnitude relates to that, particularly in light of those policies we've just discussed.
In regard to the node
type
reference?
And the scale of rural activities and how it relates to the policies in the rural section.
Commissioner Monroe.
No, thank you.
Mr. Dawson.
No, thank you.
I know we're taking a lot of time with you on this one, so I think I'll just pose some things to you because you're coming back. Again, looking at this, I shared the same concerns that Commissioner Dawson had in terms of the activity status, but I was looking at the purpose, and it says, in addition, the rural industrial subzone includes established industrial activities that are based on rural resources, and picking up some of them. So I like the way that zone was intended was to recognise things which were existing but set outside the zone. And here, I think your recommendation is that it's an appropriate zone subject to some further work. But picking up Commissioner Munro's view is, seems like Upper Clutha Transport have asked for this, and it's a good idea. There seems to be an underlying, and this is what you can tell when I'm wrong, the underlying proposition that it's a good idea to move them from where they are so it makes this site more attractive. And I'm if that is the case, I'm wondering if that is a good basis on which the design needs to be recommended. But equally, if it is for existing activities, from a planning point of view, the zoning gets put in place, but there's no guarantee necessarily that Upper Clutha will then use it or want it or take it up, and therefore it gets to be something else. So I wouldn't mind if you're going to come back that kind of more strategic look at this, and is this the appropriate mechanism, given, as I understand, it's intended to be for existing activities which are in a rural zone. So it really picks up a number of the concerns that all the commissioners have put in. Thank you.
Sure. I've already asked you.
Had you? My apologies. Mr. Place, I'd be interested in your assessment of the activities that are in the current yard, because again, I don't want to synopsize, but the current Upper Clutha yard may well have been on the edge of a small, essentially next to a pub, which driving stock trains being next to a pub is probably indicative of how long it's been there. As it exists right now, it is essentially an industrial, I'd be interested in your view of what you think it is currently, what function it performs.
So it would be, if you're reflecting on, if I just turn to my definitions. So, industrial activity means the use of land and buildings for the primary purpose of manufacturing, fabricating, processing, packaging, or associated storage of goods. And service activity is the use of land and buildings for the primary purpose of the transport, storage, maintenance, and repair of goods. It may well fit within the definition of service activity. Because that seems to have a focus on transport, storage, which I believe is Upper Clutha transport activities on that site revolve storing and then distributing raw materials.
I mean, essentially lime, farm materials, stock trains, fueling, stock transport.
That's correct.
And because where I'm coming from, and I just want to be reasonably clear with you, is that the settlement has grown up around it. That would be a fair comment. Would that be a fair comment?
Yes. You're right.
Yeah. So what we now have is a situation where Upper Clutha Yard is driving, and from a district-wide perspective, it would also be fair to say that the township of Wanaka relies on Lagat Kadrona Hawia for, and I don't want to be disrespectful, but more affordable options. So it naturally draws workers to those areas. Would that be a fair assessment in your opinion?
Potentially, but I wouldn't necessarily want to comment. I'm not exactly sure of the income statistics of people who live in Lagat, particularly.
I'm not going to hold you to it in writing. It's all just painting a picture.
Yep.
But realistically, potentially finding a home for an Upper Clutha Yard in the area that's suggested is actually potentially a positive outcome, is in that it removes the conflict from stock vehicles from the centre of a settlement. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, I believe that's the case. I recall on the site visit with the, I believe it was the owner of the company, Upper Clutha Transport, or at least the director, he was discussing with us the reverse sensitivity effects that they've been experiencing from residential occupiers across the road. So it would benefit them and the adjoining users for them to relocate. And it would be, from Ms. Hampson has commented, I believe, on the efficiency in terms of an economic perspective from maintaining activity.
So to all intents and purposes, the concerns I think that are being raised is the fit isn't potentially may work, but it's just that if you end up with 50 or the potential for 50 buildings, then that's not necessarily, or if Upper Cluton Transport decide to become an alternative, Qantas Airways, for want of a better descriptor, it's that potential. So I take comfort from your paragraph 9 in your brief that you gave us, which is the application of the RIS could be supported in a number of outstanding matters relating to landscape, traffic, etc. And from my perspective, it would be really good to get some comfort. And this is a question I'll be asking you all, Upper Cluton Transport, potentially that being addressed, and us moving forward. And with that said, over to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Place. Just to follow up on Commissioner's questions, I was reading your logic at paragraph 10.8 of your rebuttal, and I was thinking to myself, effectively the Commissioner's question, the existing yard looks like an industrial activity to me. Do you think that if that yard had been zoned general industrial, that would have been out of keeping with the existing use and the strategic direction?
In terms of their current location?
Yes, current location.
I think if they had requested general industrial zone on that specific site, then the use that's currently on that site would probably fit well within the definition, within the intent of the general industrial zone. But I haven't turned my mind significantly to the appropriateness of the general industrial zone in regard to the adjoining users. And as I discussed before, in response to Commissioner McLeod, was the reverse sensitivity effects that they're experiencing in that location. So the appropriateness in terms of the activity might be suitable, but the appropriateness as a sort of almost spot zone in a rural settlement might be questionable.
The reason I ask is that it seemed to me that if you could have a GIS in the middle of the settlement, with a small s, you could have one on the edge of the settlement.
No, I don't. As you've alluded to, my discussion in my rebuttal, I disagree that the location of the submission would fit within that direction.
I understand the point.
Yeah.
I think you're on a stronger ground talking about the separation of the proposed site from the settlement rather than that it is in or adjacent to the settlement. In terms of workers' accommodation, I wondered whether a trucking operation has probably a better, a trucking location located in a rural environment has an argument that their drivers are arriving at site late in their permitted schedule, and if they have to go somewhere else after unloading, that's going to be a problem. So that whatever the merits of workers' accommodation in urban GIS, one feature of a rural industrial site might be to make provision of workers' accommodation on the basis that precisely because it is rural, they're not conveniently located for off-site accommodation. But what's your view?
So I talked to that in my rebuttal, my first rebuttal statement, because you've identified. And I don't believe there's anything stopping Upper Cuth Transport from providing rest facilities in the buildings that they might construct on site. It's different from workers' accommodation in my view, which is a more permanent situation, which is not desirable in any industrial zone, as I've set out multiple locations in response to multiple submitters.
So is your point that they could put in temporary accommodation that would fit the bill?
I don't think it needs to be termed accommodation. I think it could just be rest facilities.
Yeah.
Would that come within just a part of the rural industrial activity definition?
It could well do. Let me just go back to that.
I mean, just like it doesn't say you can have an office or a staff facilities.
Well, so you're saying it would be excluded from that definition?
No. Oh, no. I mean, I say if you were saying there's no impediment to it being permitted in that area, it would have to come within one of the defined activities.
Yeah, correct.
Because otherwise it's a non-complying activity.
That's correct, yeah.
So you'd have to say that it could be seen as part and parcel of the sort of facilities that a rural industrial activity could be assumed to
It could well be.
Contain. Is that what you're meaning?
Yeah, I think, and I think it's worth, as I keep coming back to, separating workers' accommodation, which implies a permanent, which I don't think is what they're
not
actually trying to provide.
No.
Yeah.
It's just somewhere for them to rest.
That's right.
Where to crash overnight.
Yes, at the end of a shift when they have to have a rest before they can do another shift.
That's right. Mm. Yeah, I don't think they're asking. I don't
no,
think they're actually asking.
Move their families in and everything.
Yeah. Mm. I don't think that's what they're actually asking
for.
No,
it doesn't sound like that from their submission to me.
Thank you, Mr. Place. I think that we might be down to one, which is Bush Creek. We'll have a cup of tea first.
Great.
So, adjourn for 15 minutes, back at 22:04.